In California, there are still wildfires burning, new ones starting, and the season is just really getting rolling. It's been a bad fire season already after what seems like a lot of bad fire seasons. Our next guest says it's time for a fundamental look at humankind's relationship with fire, and we need to figure out how to live with wildfires sometimes as we enter the Pyrocene, the age of fire. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following the wildfires this year? What thoughts or questions do you have about how we manage fires? Have your views of big fires changed over the last several years? Have you ever lived in a place where wildfires were part of your daily reality? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Stephen J. Pine is professor emeritus at Arizona State University. He's written several books on fire, its history and management, including Fire, A Brief History. His latest is called The Pyrocene, How We Created an Age of Fire and What Happens Next. Steve, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thank you for the invitation.
You take a long view on fire. And one of the sort of earth-shaking things that I learned when I read your book is we didn't really have fire on this planet until we had life and particular kinds of life. Can you talk about the relationship between fire and living organisms on this planet?
Yeah, that's a great point. Fire is a creation of the living world. I mean, life created the oxygen it needs. Life on land created the fuels and arranges them. And eventually, life in the form of us provides most of the ignition. And that, in some ways, comes as a surprise because our sense of fire is so deeply embedded in our machines, appliances we make, controlling combustions. Even the dictionary definition thinks of it as a physical chemical reaction, but it's actually a biochemical reaction. Fire takes apart what photosynthesis puts together. When it occurs in our cells, we call it respiration. When it occurs in the open landscape, we call it fire. So it's been around as long as plants have been on continents. We have fossil charcoal that dates back over 420 million years.
We think sometimes of wildfires in particular as this outside force of destruction. You write that in many ecosystems, it is a regular part of the natural world that evolved in some ways along with the life forms that evolved in an ecosystem. How do we change that mindset to think of fire as part of these systems, not as an alien force?
Well, another good question. Part of it is that most of us in the industrial world, and urban industrial world especially, don't deal with open fire anymore. I mean, even at my university, students were prohibited from having candles in their dorm rooms. We found ways to substitute for it. So it's out of our life. Up until 30 years ago, we didn't really have even a science of fire ecology to understand it. It had just disappeared. So it can be problematic for people to understand how it functions. We see it today mostly vicariously, or we see it up front in the form of disasters. But one of the paradoxes we're dealing with is that these mega fires that have proved so disastrous and are continuing in California now are really a pathology of the developed world. They're something that's been created by trying to take fire out of the natural system or modifying it within the context of living landscapes. By that I mean humans have always manipulated fire. I mean, back to our hominin ancestors, you know, there's a good argument that we got small guts and big heads because we learned to cook food. And then we went to the top of the food chain because we learned to cook landscapes. We've been doing this a long time, but it always came within checks and balances that are embedded in living ecosystems. You know, you overdo it, you shorten the return interval, you do it too much under the wrong conditions, then things deteriorate and you're forced to withdraw. The real transition comes when we begin burning what I've taken to call lithic landscapes, that is once living, now fossilized landscapes in the form of coal, natural gas, petroleum, and so forth. And this kind of combustion in our hands has no boundaries. It can burn day or night, winter or summer. Seasons don't matter. It can burn wet or dry. So all of the old checks and balances that forced us to negotiate with the living landscape around us in our use of fire, our species monopoly use of fire, I might add, are gone. And suddenly the question is no longer finding more stuff to burn and ways to burn it. The problem is what to do with all the emissions and effluent from it. And we're now, you know, unhinging the atmosphere, the oceans, destabilizing biotas. In my sense, that when you add up all of these kinds of ways that our fire practices in both living and lithic landscapes, add them all up, we're creating the fire equivalent of an ice age, complete with mass extinctions, changes in sea level, large biogeographic shifts, and so forth.
We're talking to Stephen Pine about his new book, The Pyrocene, How We Created an Age of Fire and What Happens Next. Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Michael is with us in Appleton. Michael, hello.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for taking my call. I did have kind of a two-part comment, but the guest already addressed kind of, in a sense, my first part, which was about climate change. But the second reason I was calling is just to say my grandparents have some land in near Spring Green, Wisconsin, and for the last 10 or so years, my family and I have been helping do some controlled prairie burns down there to do some prairie restoration of wildflowers and the like. And it's been a really interesting and fun experience, and I've learned a lot. But just seeing even just prairie in a controlled burn, the intensity and the speed of fire like that can be really terrifying. And you can feel it from way further away than you would even think was possible.
Michael, thanks a lot for sharing that experience. Stephen, can you talk about that? One of the tools you recommend at the end of your book is going to be humans controlling fires in selected environments, starting them on purpose, but limiting them. In this case, it's a controlled prairie burn.
Well, it's almost impossible to maintain tall grass prairie without fire. If you remove fire, woody species move in very quickly, and then you have to mechanically clear them or do other things to get fire back in. And that's been known for some time, and there are other ecosystems like that. It sounds like the fires the caller is setting were pretty intense. They may not need to be so intense. Historically, people would begin burning grasslands and marshlands and others very early in the dry season. So the fires were not, you know, like a stampede of bison going through the plains. They were more like a swarm of mice chewing their way through. So you can vary the character and the timing and seasonality of fires. And you get different effect when you do that. And that's what people have always done. That's what we do uniquely. That's our ecological signature. No other creature does it. So we've sort of forgotten that and gone into our machines, and that certainly has its place, but applied to landscapes, it has been largely disastrous.
Can you talk about the possibility of that kind of controlled burn carefully in the right season in places that are wildfire prone if the fire happens in the wrong season?
Well, sure. We can look at California. It's well documented that before Europeans arrived, well, how do we know it was documented? It was after Europeans arrived. But there are plenty of accounts which show the indigenous peoples of California burning very widely, probably two or three times as much as last year's wildfires took in California. But they were doing it, they would do it early in the season. They would find a dry patch and burn it. And then that burned area would then become an anchor point for an adjacent patch when that dried out. And so you keep moving your way around. You may burn up against the snow as it retreats up the snow line. You may burn against wet areas as lakes and ponds recede and with the dry season. And then you keep working this sort of fluid jigsaw puzzle, and you've got most of the area burned by the time lightning fire becomes a possibility. So there are lots of ways, and there are good reasons for looking back in the past. How is it that, you know, humanity survived for a couple hundred thousand years using fire, living in fire-prone areas, without destroying themselves? They didn't do it the way we're doing it. And so there are a lot of things we can learn from that. We won't be doing the same stuff with the same techniques, same technologies, but we can certainly adapt it to modern conditions. And there are people doing that. And it's happening in other places. Australia is experimenting with this as well, and parts of Canada.
We're talking with Steve Pine, Professor Emeritus at Arizona State University, about his new book, The Pyrocene: How We Created an Age of Fire and What Happens Next. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about wildfires, about the way humans relate to and use fire? Have you lived in an area that experienced lots of wildfires, or do you have people living next to one right now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk now with Steve Pine, Professor Emeritus at Arizona State University, about his new book, The Pyrocene: How We Created an Age of Fire and What Happens Next. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have questions about fires, wild or otherwise, that's 800-642-1234. Before we go back to our caller, Steve, I wanted to ask about this anniversary coming up in the Midwest, 150 years in just a week or two since the same day the Great Peshtigo Fire, a wildfire that destroyed Peshtigo, Wisconsin, and a number of other smaller communities, and same day the Great Chicago Fire, an urban fire that destroyed a lot of Chicago. And it seems like once upon a time, living in a city meant you dealt with fires. It was just a thing. And we seem to have really changed that. What happened? How are we so, I think, successful in stopping that kind of, especially that kind of Chicago fire?
Yeah. Well, you know, Chicago at that time was basically a reconstituted forest. It was made out of the same materials that Peshtigo and the surrounding environments were. And it burned exactly like a forest fire under the same passing cold front, so the same meteorological systems. And gradually, after really San Francisco in 1906, large urban fires disappear. We took steps for zoning, we took steps for fire codes, building standards, building materials, plus a rather elaborate infrastructure for firefighting. And fires had more or less disappeared until they returned, started returning in the last two or three decades, actually beginning across from San Francisco and Oakland in 1990, when they'd be the first big announcement. And now it's become routine. Well, what has happened? Well, in a way, we quit doing all the things that had taken fire out of these systems. And part of it, we've defined the issue as a wildland-urban interface. It's a really geeky kind of dumb term, boiled out of California in the mid-80s. But it was defined by the wildland people who were worried about houses coming in on what were essentially forests and shrublands. And instead, that turned out to be complicated to deal with. Instead, we could have picked up the other end of that stick and said, these are basically urban fires with funny landscaping. If we had done that, it's pretty obvious you have to do to prevent these communities from burning. You treat them like little patches of cities, and you impose the same kinds of order on it that we did in larger urban areas. So now we've got a problem and a lot of retrofitting to do, and it's going to be awkward and expensive. But the good news is that we had done it before, and we can do it again. We know how. In the same way, Peshtigo started off an age, 50 years, megafires, in many ways an order of magnitude larger and more lethal than what we've seen recently. And that also suggests we can deal with it if we choose to.
We had a caller who couldn't stay on the line, Steele in Appleton, who wondered how many of the wildfires we're seeing, the initial cause can be pinned on some kind of arson and intentionally set fire versus other, I guess, man-made accidental causes or, as you mentioned earlier, those lightning strikes.
Well, the proportion of lightning in human depends where you are, how much lightning is. It's not even just a number of lightning. It's whether the lightning occurs in kind of a dry climate. But arson fires are pretty small. They arouse lots of attention for obvious reasons. In fact, it's that one currently going in Northern California has been identified as arson. The most lethal ones in recent years have been power lines because they fail in high winds. Exactly the time when a fire, if it's arc, gets started, it's going to blow out of control before we can contain it. So most of the fires that threaten communities are human-caused, directly or indirectly. Probably only 2 or 3% are coming from further out and from lightning. Arson, one of the ways to stop arson, though, let me back up. Power of fire resides in the power to propagate. It spreads. And the way to remove that power from fire is prevent it from spreading. And that you do by trolling the larger landscape. And there are lots of ways to do it. You don't have to nuke it or pave it. There are lots of things we can do. And that is a way to control, to take the power of arson fire away. It simply won't be able to do the damage it would if that landscape were in a more fire-prone, more fire-explosive condition.
We're talking to Steve Pine about his new book, The Pyroscene, How We Created an Age of Fire and What Happens Next. Let's go back to your calls now. John is with us in Ashland. John, hi.
Hi. One very quick story and one question. I had a friend who, when he became an adult, he confessed once that as a little kid, he didn't see much of his dad, who was a firefighter. And so he used to deliberately set fires near the house so that he could see his dad. I mean, that blew me away. But the question I had was, President Trump had talked about cleaning the forest floor, and that's why we have these fires in California. And then I read later that people actually do thin out forests. It creates less of a possibility of fire igniting. Can you address that and whether that, in fact, takes place?
Sure. No, there are lots of things. Our forests are not in good shape, most of them, particularly in the West. A lot of this actually began in the 19th century with overgrazing, which took the grasses out that had routinely carried fire and then gave rise to thickening woods that came in. Now, this was 20, 30 years before the Forest Service even came on the scene. And then logging introduced enormous amounts of slash. And that is what powered the Peshtigo Fire and this cycle, 50-year cycle of megafires, mostly around the Great Lakes and the northern border with Canada, and actually across the lakes in Canada. So there's plenty of evidence for that. More recently, the issue has been one of having removed fire. Our forests were often in bad shape. Fire was seen as a contributor to that problem. They sought to remove fire, but then they never realized they needed to put it back in another form again. So the forests have come to assume a shape that makes fires more eruptive, makes it difficult to contain them, and can make them burn more severely than they would have otherwise. There are lots of things you can do to restore that. There's a kind of thinning process. We're not talking about logging, taking big stuff. We're talking about taking the small stuff, which is really what fire burns. And it's a kind of woody weeding, thinning that out, reintroducing fire, both of which can be relatively benevolent ways of getting a landscape into a form where we can control the bad fires that we don't want and promote the good fires that we do. So there are many, many varieties of things we can do. You could also reintroduce beavers, for example, in places. They create wet fire breaks. Other places, you may want, you could reintroduce prairie dogs in parts of the Great Plains. They produce fire breaks. There are all kinds of sort of ecological things you can do to improve it. Grazing and browsing animals can be important. There are places where goats and sheep can be used, again, under prescribed conditions. So there are many things, and most places will require a suite of treatment, a cocktail of treatments adapted to their particular circumstances.
John, thanks for that call. And just our last minute or so, Steve, how important is trying to rein in climate change to preventing ranges of fires from expanding to places where we're not used to them, tough fire seasons where we are used to them?
Sure. There are a lot of treatments we can do to mitigate the crises that are evolving around us. But ultimately, we have to get a handle on climate change or it will override all of the other things we could do. So I see us doing a bunch of things to keep cities and communities from burning. That could be done in a handful of years if we really chose. We can get our landscapes in better shape within a handful of decades. Climate change will be longer, but we need to do all of them at the same time.
Steve, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Okay.
That's Stephen Pine. Stephen Pine, Professor Emeritus at Arizona State University. We talked to him about his new book called The Pyrocene, How We Created an Age of Fire and What Happens Next.